right, y'all. The equipment did not want to work today, but we're doing the thing. Hey, you guys. Hi, everybody. I hope you guys are having a good day. It is a pretty okay day for me. I am keeping to time. I'm kind of like 20 minutes behind what I'm supposed to be doing right now, but I'm in my chair. I'm doing the thing, so I'm proud of myself. If you know me from TikTok, you know that I have some certain mental health issues that I struggle with, so I take my wins very seriously. So yeah, I feel pretty good today. That's what I wanted to share with you guys, and I hope you guys are also having a good day. I hope you are accomplishing whatever it is that you set out to do today, whether it's just, you know, lay in bed all day, or maybe take your kids out, go out on your own, do a self date, whatever it is, right? Whatever it is that you said you were supposed to do today, I hope you actually get it done. I hope you feel good today. I hope you're drinking your water. I have a really good feeling about today, and I know that it might not be amazing for everybody, but I hope it's good for you. All right, you guys, thank you so much for being here and welcome back to Heinous Beliefs. Again, this is a podcast where we dive deep into true crime cases intertwined with twisted ideologies, belief systems, and distorted faith. I'm your host, Rhea, and I'm grateful again for you guys to join me today. Before we begin, though, a quick heads up. Today's episode is heavy. Just like the other ones, it's a bit unsettling. It's involving mass murder and a lot of manipulation under religion. Listener discretion is always advised over here, you guys. So please take care of yourselves, okay? If you find this episode amazing, if you like it, if you find it 5-star worthy, please go ahead and put a 5-star review wherever you're listening. If it's anything less than 5 stars, please just hold on to it until I am 5-star worthy. Thank you again for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you're here for the first time, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you tuning in. Make sure you go back and listen to the other episodes, because I think we're on episode 14 right now, or maybe 15. So you have a lot to binge on, okay? Make sure you are catching up on the other episodes. Tell people about the podcast. If you love it, if you like it, you like listening to it, share it out to your family members. All right, you guys. So today we are venturing into Uganda. We are going to be talking about a movement that was called the Movement for the Restoration of the Ten Commandments of God. Okay. That's the name. Okay. I wasn't just talking. That's the name. I'm going to repeat it. Okay. The Movement for the Restoration of the Ten Commandments of God. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. Go ahead and grab your tea, grab your coffee, get cozy, get comfortable. Eyes on the road. Okay. Make sure you're safe. Let's get into it. So let's rewind the clock and drop ourselves in late 1980s, Uganda. The country was still trying to catch its breath after years of chaos. We're talking civil wars, dictatorship under Idi Amin. I'm pretty sure I said that name right. And the brutal Bush War that brought the president, Yoweri Museveni, into power in 86. People were exhausted mentally, spiritually, emotionally. And when folks were going through this kind of trauma, they started to look for answers, peace, you know, something that will explain what is happening, anything that feels like stability. Okay. Now imagine this. In the middle of all that, out of the smoke and silence comes this new religious movement. This wasn't your typical Bible study group. This was one that claimed to be the last heaven's call. If you are not part of this group, you are not making it to heaven. This was not just any other church. This was the church. Okay. They said that they were here to restore the Ten Commandments and guide people safely into the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God. At first, it didn't sound bad, right? Like, pretty much that's what all these other churches are claiming. But this one was saying, hey, these other churches are wrong. If you're not part of us, don't even worry about it, right? A lot of Ugandans were pretty much already deeply religious, mostly Roman Catholics, obviously colonization. You already know how that goes, right? They were mostly Roman Catholic and Anglican. So people were already primed and ready for something like this, right? It wasn't out of the blue. that there was a doomsday cult somewhere because, you know, there was already a foundation there of that kind of belief. But here's the thing. This group didn't just ask people to pray and live right. They said the world was ending, like literally soon, right? And if you wanted to survive the fire and brimstone, they said you had to follow them. You had to obey the commandments to the letter, the Ten Commandments, and do anything that they said, no questions asked. Sounding more like a cult, right? You know, at this point, we're just not calling it a cult yet, right? We're just saying, hey, this is a religious group, right? Because we don't want to offend them. Apparently, that's the thing in society. We don't want to call cults because it's not politically correct to say that. I guess this group started to grow like so fast. They started recruiting poor village people, small towns, you know, uneducated people, people that are not necessarily looking for anything outside of just making sure that they have shelter, food, water. Because again, these are people that are coming out of chaos, okay? Survival is really the main focus here, right? So whatever would feel like liberation for them is what they're gonna latch on to. They came up as this righteous group of people that were sent down to clean up modern society, right? But underneath all of that holy nonsense, everything about that society or that organization was dark. There was something dark and dangerous that was already about to come to the surface. So the part where people are joining, they're very much not thinking about anything deeper than when I die, I will be a part of this group and I can make it to heaven. All right, guys. So let's dive into the minds behind all of this madness. These are two people, Joseph Kibuetere and Sordonia Merende. These two people are the leaders of this religious movement, if you want to call them that, okay? So Joseph was a respected Catholic in the society, a father of seven, and he also dipped into Ugandan politics. Back in 1970s, he was known as a community leader and a devout follower of the Catholic Charismatic Renewal Movement. This is a whole nother movement, okay? Has nothing to do with this one. But after he claimed to have had a vision of the Virgin Mary in 1984, everything changed. He said the Virgin told him that the world was full of sin and he had to save it, right? He had to save the world from how sinful it got. After that, he disappeared from public. He was isolated. He had a mental breakdown. At least that's what most of the witnesses are saying. They said he had a time where he wasn't so sane. Others say that he was just getting in tune with the Lord, right? He was just having a spiritual encounter and he was getting closer to God. And honestly, I am starting to see a pattern here. I'm starting to see a pattern of, you know, when we obviously see mental health issues being harmful to society, we see it being harmful to people around us, right? And instead of reconciling with that reality, we rather say that the person is having a spiritual encounter and they're getting closer to God, right? But why does closer to God always look like a mental breakdown? Like, are you trying to insinuate that this God has no other way to communicate with you without breaking your brain, without causing you harm? Why again should I be serving this God? Now, Sedonia's story is a bit different. She is either a beer brewer or a sex worker, depending on what source you read. She is from the Kananugu district in Uganda, and allegedly that's where she started to have her visions of the Virgin Mary. After her father died was her first vision. She told people that the Virgin Mary had chose her to spread a message of repentance and that the apocalypse was near. The apocalypse was coming. Now, word on the street is she was so fierce and charismatic that she pretty much ran the whole operation that same way, right? She ruled with the iron fist. Like, even though Joseph was a figurehead in the organization, insiders say Sardonia was the boss. She was pretty much running the whole thing. She was the one organizing everything from the teachings to the money and later to the end game, to when they finished this whole thing off. And I'll tell you guys about that later. Now, in 1989, joined forces and created what would become the Movement for the Restoration of the Ten Commandments of God. I told y'all about these names. Look, if you come to me with one of these names, I will laugh at you. I've told y'all this before. I still don't understand how people fall for this stuff, because by the time you're on the third word, I'm like, what are you talking about? The Movement for the Restoration of the Ten Commandments of God. Huh? At first, it looked like just another offshoot Catholicism. They even registered the group with the Ugandan government as a legit religious organization. They claimed that they weren't a church, but a movement strictly focused on obeying the Ten Commandments, especially the eighth one, thou shalt not bear false witness. That's why members were barely allowed to talk. Silence was a virtue, they said. Talking too much was how lies were spread, okay? They also believed that the world was gonna end and that only true believers would be saved. They recruited former priests, nuns, educated people, whole families, even disillusioned Catholics who felt like mainstream church was too worldly and they wanted something more traditional, right? By the 90s, they had hundreds of followers, lands in multiple districts, right? They were collecting tithes, property, and even children from followers. This was the part that Sardonia, you know, was more interested in, the children. But here's where it gets worse, okay? Now, Joseph and Sardonia kept a tight inner circle where they were super secretive. This inner circle was not to talk to anybody else. And there were even books of messages that they said were written by the Virgin Mary herself. Sardonia claimed that she channels the Virgin Mary and pretty much writes on the book what the Virgin Mary wants them to do. Only the core leadership could read it. Sound familiar? Okay. Followers were told that the leaders were in direct contact with God and any doubt was seen as rebellion. Okay. No one is leaving. Once you're in, you're in. You can't get out. I don't know why we do this voluntarily, but this is the decision that they're making here. So these two were not just spiritual leaders. They were master manipulators. They played the long game. They built an entire empire on fear, silence, and the end of the world mumbo jumbo. Now let's talk about how they locked people in mentally. The Movement for the Restoration of the Ten Commandments of God wasn't just talking about being good or living right. No. They looked at it as just, it's not enough. You can't just do that, right? These people built their whole doctrine around fear. Like, you step out of line, you burn in eternity, okay? You do one thing wrong, don't even worry about it, okay? Don't even worry about praying. Don't worry about forgiveness. You're done, okay? You're burning in that fire. They were heavy on the apocalyptic prophecies. The big claim here was that the world was going to end on January 1st, 2000. It's 2025. Yeah. Not just figuratively, though. They meant literal flames, floods, tears from the sky. These people were ready for destruction, okay? They said only the people who followed the Ten Commandments strictly, obeyed the Ten Commandments, would make it through alive, right? All this destruction they're telling you about, all of the fire, the floods, the destruction, the earthquakes. If you believe in this God, all you have to do, just believe in the God and follow the Ten Commandments to a T, and you'll make it. I talked about how they barely spoke because of the eighth commandment that says, thou shalt not bear false witness. So because of this commandment, they completely decided that just don't talk at all, right? There's no point of talking at all because you could say something wrong. You could lie. You could say something that is false against your neighbor or whatever. So just forget about the whole talking part. So talking was basically banned unless it was essential. It had to be absolutely essential before you could speak. That's why members often communicated with signs and gestures. Whole conversations were silent to avoid sin. Members were told to give up everything, their homes, their farms, their clothes, even their kids. It all had to go to the cult leaders. They claimed it was a test of faith, but in reality, it was all financial control, plain and simple. Some people were even writing over their lands, their deeds, their titles to this movement, and even not questioning any of it. If you had any doubts, you were labeled as evil or possessed by demons. Cerdonia was especially intense about this part. According to former members interviewed by BBC and Ugandan police, she ran the compound like a military base. They had eating times that were so far apart. It was pretty much just like snacks three times a day. They hardly had meals. They had days that were filled with rituals, fasting, and just silence. They didn't even let people wear clothes because it was in vain. Music? No. Celebration? Mm-mm. Their whole lives just became one whole prep for doomsday. And it wasn't just mind games, right? It was isolation. Members were cut off from family, from the outside world. Letters were censored. Visitors were just rare. There was pretty much no visit. Like, where are you going to go? Who's going to let you in? Phones? Non-existent. These leaders pretty much created this echo chamber where everything they said was law. Nothing outside of that organization was going in and out of these people's ears. Now, outside reality was completely banned. There's nothing else that you need to know outside of the organization. It was all psychological control wrapped in some language of righteousness and Jesus and, you know, Virgin Mary. It's like they have to say these key words to kind of get you, you know, the Jesus, the Virgin Mary. It just locks you in, especially with an organization that's already familiar with those names and those symbols and what they symbolize. And, you know, they've been used to colonize them for so long. I'm not surprised that those figures would draw these people into an organization like this. Now, the voluntary suffering part, the wanting to, you know, doom yourself down and close every happiness that you could possibly have because of doomsday, that part I don't understand. Okay, that part I can never really get my head around. And sadly, people followed this stuff, right? Not because they were dumb or weak, but because they were desperate for some kind of hope, some kind of purpose, protection in this horrible world. There's a lot of chaos happening right now. And everything else had pretty much already failed them. So yeah, this wasn't just about belief. It was about control. All right. So now we are in 1999 and it's winding down. The year's about to end and we are going into 2000, right? Remember, Doomsday is supposed to come January 1st, 2000. So as 2000 is creeping up, the leaders, organization leaders are full on panic mode, right? They're on panic prep mode. They're getting ready. Like, they had their followers out here wilding, selling all their stuff, giving up land, pulling their kids out of school, quitting jobs, abandoning family, all because their leaders told them that on January 1st, 2000, the world was going to end. No metaphor, no parable, just pure flames and destruction for everybody. But then nothing happened. Midnight hit and world kept going. Everybody else kept going to work. The world kept spinning. The sun kept shining. Nothing happened. And you could feel the shift of energy, right? You could feel people being confused, even pissed off. Some of the followers started asking real questions like, where is Jesus? You said the world was going to end. And why didn't we leave? You know, why didn't we get taken up? You know, why is my family still here? Pretty much trying to figure out where's the promise that was made. And when money starts getting questioned, that's when the cult leaders started to panic for real. Especially when all the cash that was given to them, the land that was sold, the properties that had already been transferred to them, that pressure, right, to make sure that you're taking care of things before doomsday had these people giving up all of their earthly possessions, right? Now, Sardonia and Joseph knew that people were closing in on them and they were losing control. And these people were pretty much wanting answers for the fact that they did not get anything in return for all of the properties and everything that they gave these folks, right? And as they're realizing that, they come up with this bright idea of a new prophecy. They said God was just testing them. Now, the real date was on March 17, 2000. But this time it was guaranteed. No delay, no doubt, just fire and ascension. Now, to keep these people from leaving, they planned a massive send-off party in Kananugu. And this wasn't just a regular Sunday service, because, you know, they've been void of any kind of fun because they were preparing for this doomsday, right? They were preparing for the Lord to come and burn everything down and take them. They roasted bulls and cooked and just made a ton of food, but that's not really the norm for them, right? Now, former members were reporting that the vibe was off because these were people, like I said, that were pretty much void of happiness. They were not used to doing things like this. We're talking about people here that have pretty much been living as monks. They haven't had any type of celebration, happiness, anything like that. That's when a few people started to try to, you know, figure out what was going on. They started getting a bit suspicious because it sounds like y'all are just trying to pull the wool over our eyes at this point, right? Now you're trying to tell us that what we are seeing and what we're thinking is not what we're seeing and it's not what we're thinking. But witnesses say that some people would pull them aside and say, hey, you're gonna miss salvation. Sometimes they were even threatened, okay? They were threatened that they were going to miss salvation if they left, if they kept asking these questions. Now, this entire event was painted as the final night before the faithful would be taking up to heaven again, right? The first one was a test, though. So this one is real. The vibe was very much like culty, euphoric, and also just weird, right? And behind the scenes, some of the leaders had already left. They were gone. They were out of Kananugu before the night had even started. Now, the two main leaders were still there, but others had dipped, like they left. Everything about this moment was staged. The bulls, the food, the music, it was all bait to keep these people from questioning the lie. And tragically, it kind of worked. Well, obviously, plus the threatening, right? Okay, so now it's March 17, 2000. Here is where I'm gonna give trigger warning, okay? You guys make sure that you are not listening around kids or anything like that, or just for yourselves, listener discretion is advised again, okay? Now, that's the day everything pretty much exploded, for lack of better words, literally, okay? After 500 men and women and children showed up to Kananugu Church, they dressed in their best, singing hymns, fasting, and praying. Now, on March 17, 2000, like I was saying, this was the day that was supposed to be the new doomsday. This was the day that God actually was going to come, because remember, the other one was a test. And because of the reaction of the congregation the last time they did this, this was their solution to, I guess, fulfill the prophecy. Over 500 men, women, and children showed up to the Kananugu Church dressed in their best. They were singing, fasting, and praying. This energy, like, you know, this apocalyptic revival, you know, a lot of emotions going. It was very heightened. People truly believed that they were about to meet God. They were told that this was their ascension day, judgment day, if you will, right? They were promised heaven, and you guys, it became hell on earth. As soon as everyone got inside the building, right? When they got into the church, the doors and the windows were sealed, barred up with like wood. You know how they close off the windows with wood on the outside? So they couldn't take it off from the inside. It was on the outside. They couldn't leave, even though they wanted to. A few people reportedly tried to get out the minute they realized that the windows were barred. But the exits were also locked off. The guards kept everyone inside. Yes, there were guards. Okay. There were people posted at the doors to keep them from leaving. Then came the explosion. Some believe that it was timed with the flammable chemical mix. Definitely not an accident, though. This wasn't like a gas leak or anything like that. The building went up in flames so fast, it was like a fireball dropped from the sky. Forensic analysis said that the presence of sulfuric acid and gasoline inside of the church created an inferno so hot that the bodies were burned beyond recognition. Bones fused together, skulls charred black. Like, this was not like a whole hours long fire. Okay, this was a boom type explosion. And because of all the chemicals that they used, sulfuric acid and gasoline, this was a very, very hot fire. Investigators recovered less than a dozen bodies that could, you know, be partially identified. Ugandan police later confirmed that this wasn't just an act of desperation. It was a setup, a full-blown murder operation disguised as a holy send-off. The explosion was deliberate, and it was a conscious decision that was made here. The fire was premeditated. This wasn't just some group suicide pact. No one in that church, apart from the guards, knew what was going to be happening that day. Now, the two leaders, gone. It was a slaughter, planned, executed by the very people who claim to be shepherding these people to salvation. Now, like I told you guys earlier, some of the cult leaders were not there. We did have the people that were standing guard. They also were in the explosion. I guess theirs would be voluntary. So they were in there with the people that were blown up in the explosion. Now, Joseph and Sardonia and the other ones that left that night, they weren't interested in leaving, you know, the earth. They were not interested in seeing God that day. They were not interested in the apocalypse. So they left, while 550, right, of their followers were burned alive. Some sources say 530, some people say 550. Depends on what source you have. But most sources say there were 550 people and they were burned alive, locked inside what they thought was a house of worship of their God. And it gets worse, because this fire was just one of many other apocalyptic events that were supposed to be happening that day. Okay. They found other locations of this movement that had mass graves and bodies in those mass graves. These victims showed signs of poisoning, stabbing, indicating a mass murder that was premeditated and systematically executed, just like the fire. Now, one of the graves had 155 bodies, another one had 153 bodies, and the last one had 81 bodies. So there were other apocalyptic events that were happening that day as well. You know, this belief here needs people to die before the world can end. So yeah, the fire was not their only plan here, because again, there was a lot of doubt being raised because the first apocalypse that was promised didn't come true. And they thought maybe actually killing these people would, you know, maybe fix the problem, I guess, right? Because if there's no people, then there's no one to question them. God did it, right? When the news first broke, people in Kananugu just kind of thought that it was one of these like mass murders, these cults that, you know, are usually just like doing mass murders in the name of their beliefs. It was so normal back then that people started to compare it to Jamestown. So they didn't really, you know, look into it anymore. But later on, the news does come out that, you know, this was not a mass suicide. This was mass murder. The windows and the doors were nailed shut from the outside. People could not run. People could not leave. This was an execution, cold, calculated. The police also found a receipt near the compound of sulfuric acid just that day before the fire went down. Forensics said that the church was practically a furnace waiting to blow. It was no way out of that. They designed it to burn fast and hot, to leave no traces. It was intentional, right? So finally, the police go ahead and get warrants out for Joseph and Sardonia and four other top members of this cult. Remember that inner circle I told you guys about? Even though they had warrants out, they could not find any of these people. Okay, they were gone. Witnesses claimed that they saw trucks leaving the area the night before, and the word on the street that somebody even claimed that Sardonia was in a DRC. She had already gone. Now, Uganda had to ask Kenya, Rwanda, and Congo to try to help track these people down, but nothing. No seeings, no sightings, no arrests, just a whole lot of dead ends. And this case became one of the coldest unsolved cases in East Africa ever since. Over 500 people were murdered in the name of faith, and the masterminds have pretty much vanished, okay? No retribution, no accountability, nothing. No trials, no justice, just pain, trauma, and a whole country left wondering, how the hell do you bring justice to ghosts? God never found them. God never fished them out. God never helped the police find them. He's fine with them getting away with it. That's what I'm getting from this, because if y'all are going to tell me that somehow they're going to get their judgment later, I'm going to need you to make sure that I'm there, because I don't know how y'all think you're going to get justice just because you think about it, right? These people are off in the wind. They did what they did. This was a calculated mass murder. These people were burned to death. No accountability for that. There's no accountability whatsoever. I don't know why there's no expectation for the God to help criminals get caught, but you know, that's just me, right? That's a really huge expectation, apparently. Now, they use religion as a weapon. We can see that here, right? They painted this picture of eternal suffering. If you don't follow every little rule, they turned around and said, if you stick with us, if you obey exactly what we say, you'll be saved, right? I honestly get why people would want to leave this earth and move on to something better, something bigger, something greater. But at the end of the day, the reality is this is all we have. This is all we have. And if we don't take care of it, then we won't have a future, right? We want to stay in La La Land and we want to jump off the boat. We want to jump off the planet because you know what? It's too hard. But guess what? Beliefs like this are not helping you do that, right? Why don't you have a belief that you should take care of the earth because you're going to go on to somewhere better and you just want to have, you know, the earth be good for the people that you're leaving behind? Why is that not a belief? Why is that not what the God wants you to do? Why does he ignore the horrible things that are happening here, right? The damage that's happening here, he ignores that and asks you to go do all these horrible things to other people. Right? You're giving up your family. You're ignoring your family. You're ostracizing your family. You're isolating your family, isolating yourself, bringing children into this. At the end of the day, guys, you just have to maybe think about what it means to you to believe something, right? Why do I believe this thing? What is so important here that I need to believe about an afterlife if the one life that I have in front of me is not that amazing? Why don't I repair what I have here? And honestly, again, we are talking about people that were in war times, in chaos, but I think maybe if people, especially in those times, came together to just realize, like, maybe we should not be fighting, right? Even the people that are starting these wars, a lot of them are religious based. Maybe we should ask God to give us a different mission, you know, that does not require pain and suffering and trauma, killing people. Why don't y'all ask for stuff like that? I mean, I don't know. Anyway, guys, watch out for subscriptions. We are done here. We are done with this episode. I love you guys so much for sticking around. Thank you so much. And also, please, guys, interact with the Instagram page. Like the pictures, comment, whatever comes to mind about these cases, put them in the comment section. Like, if you have a question about a case, put them in the comment section. If you have something to say about a case, put it in the comment section. Just do all the interacting things, okay? Because I need that page to get a little bit more traction so that way these pictures can go out on the explore page and people can see it. Y'all know how that goes, right? So please help me with that. Also, if you would like to help me out with my podcast, subscriptions are the best way to do that, y'all. I'm paying for a lot of the platforms that I have the podcast on, and I really don't know how long I can keep on going. So subscriptions are a way for me to kind of get that money back that I'm paying for the platforms. So pretty much that's what the subscriptions are gonna be for. Thank you so much. Have a good rest of your day. Bye, guys.